Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Your hosts for today are Susan Franson and Gina McAndrews. Welcome to both of you.
We are happy to be together again with you, Mike. There's a lot of variety in this show, and I think it will be a challenge to keep up with our guests. But first, we need to start with a holiday. Cinco de Mayo, the May 5th. We have Juan Rodriguez, who not only has a restaurant named Cinco de Mayo, but is a Latino businessman who has several different kinds of enterprises.
This is a Cinco de Mayo, and it is being celebrated, I guess, all over the world, but certainly in the Western Hemisphere. And I think for many gringos, it's just a great day to go to a Mexican restaurant and drink margaritas. But it has another more serious meaning. And so we are speaking with the owner of a restaurant
in Des Moines named
Cinco de Mayo to tell us what it's all about. Hi. Juan Rodriguez.
Yeah, hello. Hello, everybody. Yeah, this is our Cinco de Mayo special day for Mexican, more for the American people than the Mexican people, because the Cinco de Mayo is a big celebration, but it's not the Independence Day of Mexico. Independence Day of Mexico is September 16th, but Cinco de Mayo is the first battle when the independence started. It was in May 5th of 1862, I was between the Mexican people and the French army. It's a very a significant battle, because it was the Mexican people didn't have the number first and the second guns as the French army. So that made the difference. Mexican people won that battle, and that it was a big moral boost for the independence. So that's the meaning. But here we celebrate with margaritas and delicious food.
So it's a good day to have a Mexican restaurant, right?
Yes, it is, to enjoy the food and enjoy the margaritas and everything. Being here in U.S., you know, it's a big opportunity for all the immigrants. And I thank this state, Iowa, and this country. I am from Colombia, but I love this country. I moved from my country about 18 years ago. So I've been doing like entrepreneur, doing different things. I'm doing, you know, the restaurant is one of the other things, but I have more businesses, and thanks to this country where the, you know, the dreams come true if you work hard, and that it's an amazing place. Cinco de Mayo is more for Americans than Mexicans. But yeah, it is a special day too.
You were talking about businesses. What are your other businesses besides Cinco de Mayo?
When I moved from Colombia in 2003, I moved to Illinois. And then I moved to Iowa. I came to visit someone, help someone to drive. And I like Des Moines. And I started working here in Des Moines. The only job that I found at that time, because I didn't speak much English, it was in cleaning. So I started working in Drake University in facility service, cleaning bathrooms and that stuff. But at the same time, I started the insurance business. That it was my main business currently. So I have the insurance agency here in Des Moines. I also have a couple Spanish radio stations. And I have the restaurant and an event center. So this country is an amazing place where you can make a lot of things. So I'm very happy to be here, and for me this is the paradise with the country that allow me to come here and allow me to do this much of things that I really appreciate. That it's a big thing for me, being a farmer in my country without, you know, much opportunity coming here and doing business like I am doing right now. It's an amazing thing.
Well, you said you had two radio stations. Where are they?
Oh, yeah, sure. One of those is KDLF in Boone. The other one is KDLF in Perry. But both of those cover Des Moines, cover the 1260 AM, it's KDLF. It covers like around 60% of the state. So we have Mexican music, Hispanic music, and also we have news, we have live shows, and mostly we use it for inform the community, to talk about the issues with the community, to let educate people about different issues happening in the community. So we invite the police officers, we invite different organizations to talk about everything basically happening in the community. So it's a good tool that we have, educate and help people. The pandemic is affecting every single business in the country. Last Saturday, my neighbor here in the town, one of the across the street, he closed the place because he couldn't find employees. So now the pandemic effect, when we close, we have to close the businesses. But now we open the businesses, but there is no people to work. It's hard to find employees, hard to find the right person, because I'm not sure if maybe what's going on with that, what's happening, because with the radio stations, we are running a lot of advertisement campaigns looking for employees, different companies, and they are paying really good money, and they are not finding much employees. So in my restaurant, we start offering, normally it's $4.35 per hour plus tips, but now we are offering $6 plus tips, and it's not showing, nobody is showing up. And I found another business owner here in downtown that he's offering $10 plus tips, and he cannot find employees. So we are struggling with the now finding employees.
So that is your biggest problem.
Yes.
Is not finding employees. Presumably you really want Spanish-speaking employees, right?
Yes. We normally employ, you know, if they speak both languages, it's great, because we market the Spanish people. But we don't, in this time, we don't care who is applying for the jobs. We take every application, but nobody's showing up to apply. So something is happening, and I talked today with somebody in Texas, and they are having the same problem. And I talked to someone in Miami yesterday, and they are having the same problem. They are not finding employees.
And you don't understand why. I mean, they're certainly
still
immigrants being deported, so why can't they just let them stay and work?
I don't know if that's the problem, or not only Latinos is not finding Latinos to work. It's American companies looking for for employees, and they are not finding enough. So I hear from someone that some of the other business owners, they are telling that it's because they are in unemployment, and they are getting X from the federal government, that they are prefer to stay at home than come to work, because they make basically more money staying at home than showing up to work and working 40 hours a week. So I don't know if that's 100% true, but it's a rumor only. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk to your people, to your listeners. I personally, thanks to this country to give me the opportunity to come here and work hard and do what I am doing. Thank you all the people who support my business. And yeah, it's been a great place to work and raise the family.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye, Juan.
In case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We just heard from Juan Rodriguez with a surprising interpretation of the country where Cinco de Mayo is the most popular.
But it's also a successful immigrant story.
It is good to have something good happening and hear more about it. We've been hearing about the awful problems of the immigrant children at the border.
Well, we have a hopeful story there as well. We have the president of the National Latino Organization Forward Latinos,
Daryl Moraine,
who came to Iowa to talk with our governor. I was able to talk with him about the outcome just a couple of hours after their meeting. I recorded our discussion.
My name is Daryl Moraine. I'm national president for Forward Latino. We're a nonpartisan, nonprofit advocacy and service organization assisting Latinos throughout 29 states of our great country. We advocate on issues ranging from immigration to education to health care and so much more. And that's what brought us to Iowa today.
So would you describe a little the steps that got you here? Because this has been going on for a little while.
Yes. Well, through our membership here in Iowa, we learned that Governor Kim Reynolds had issued a statement saying that she would not authorize unaccompanied minors who are arriving at our southern border to come to the state of Iowa as they seek shelter and as the federal system is overwhelmed. So we wanted to come today and share a little about the facts around their plight and highlight that, once again, there's an ask for states to receive hundreds, not thousands, of these young children who are just seeking the safety of the United States.
And what kind of a response did you get from Governor Reynolds?
Well, we provided a lot of factual information. We're going to be providing some additional information, but the governor's senior staff echoed that they were limited on resources here and did not believe that Iowa had the resources to accommodate a few hundred of these unaccompanied minors.
And how did you respond to that?
We shared with them that we'll be providing them additional information, et cetera, and hoped that the governor may see to amend her position in the not too distant future.
And what did you present to her that you thought would be convincing?
Mm-hmm. Well, we discussed, we brought with us a briefing binder, which included the United Nations report on refugees out of and asylum seekers out of the Northern Triangle, which are some of the most dangerous countries in the world. And the Northern Triangle is made up of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. We shared the actual numbers of unaccompanied minors that are currently that the HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, is currently seeking assistance with. There's, as of March 31st, there's a total of 12,900 of these unaccompanied minors. And there's a common misconception that there's hundreds of thousands overwhelming the border, and that's simply not the fact. We also clarified that there's been no open borders policy implemented by the Biden administration. And in fact, the Biden administration has come under some critical fire by some more progressive organizations for leaving many of the previous administration's policies in place. So once again, just sharing the facts from trusted, credible resources and leaving the rhetoric to the side. We also highlighted that we understand that immigration is a complicated and very divisive issue for many, and that it's important that as people of faith and know that Iowa is a state with strong conviction, a sense of moral responsibility and faith, that we must be willing to take in and assist the most vulnerable. And who could be more vulnerable than young children fleeing extreme violence and imminent danger?
Do you have any contacts with organizations in Iowa that are willing to help you?
Yeah, so we are we have a number of affiliates in the state, such as a number of LULAC councils, et cetera. But we welcome anybody who wants to have the dialogue or organizations that want to do more in this area to please feel free to contact us at 833-LATINO-1 or visit our website at www.forwardlatino.org. And while we had an opportunity to discuss the humanitarian crisis on the border, we also were able to discuss another issue where we did find almost immediate common ground, and it's the need to ensure vaccine equity during this pandemic, and had a series of discussions, and I believe proposals are going to be coming out of that so that we can collaborate with the governor's office and respective state agencies to ensure that Latinos throughout Iowa have easy access to the vaccine.
Well, it should be a good time because the governor is running into a lot of resistance from Iowans to even take the vaccine that we have.
Yeah. And that is a growing concern. There's just, once again, been so much misinformation that's been spread out there, you know, in all manners. So we'll be working with them on messaging and potential campaigns and additional locations, in fact, where they can throw up vaccination sites. We know the sooner we get everyone vaccinated, the sooner everyone will be able to go back to life as we knew it before, the sooner our schools and our businesses can truly reopen, not the pseudo reopening that everyone likes to talk about, but truly reopen and really allow Iowa to be everything we know the state can be.
Is there any other message that you'd like to get across?
Yeah. Well, I'd just like to say we appreciated the opportunity to meet with such a large number of the governor's senior staff on these important issues, and I believe it's laid the groundwork for us to be able to have future discussions and collaborate on more issues that are so important to Iowa's Latino community and, in turn, Latinos, Iowa's future.
And could you give me the contact information? I didn't get a chance to write it down.
Okay, so it's 833. So it's an 800 number, but it's 833. Latino, L-A-T-I-N, and then O, and then the number 1.
Okay.
So Latino 1. And then our website is www.forwardlatino.org. I don't know if Joe shared this with you as well, but are you familiar with the case Natalia Miranda? The
No.
14-year-old girl who was run over 2 years ago for being Mexican?
No.
Okay, that happened here in Iowa. And in fact, we just met with her father. This last week, the lady who did intentionally run her over for being Mexican pleaded guilty to a hate crime. And we've been advocating with the Department of Justice for just under 2 years on that. So it was nice to see that finally happen. We've also ran radio campaign here over the holidays, encouraging people to celebrate safe. And only
How are
with
you?
The people
you
in their homes, once again, trying to limit spread. So there's been a number of different things we've done in Iowa, and I think you're only going to see us doing more.
Sounds hopeful, but he is going home. That's good news. I'd like to know what's going to come from the promises of Governor Reynolds.
Our friend Joe Enrique Henry, political director for the League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC, is a friend of Daryl Moraine, and will be following up on the policies just outlined by Daryl. Joe can come to a future show and let us know what progress is being made. Let's take a short music break and come back and talk with some enthusiastic people from Boone about saving an important piece of Boone history. This is KHOI Community Radio, And your hosts for today are Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews. A couple of weeks ago, the Boone News Republican had a color picture on the front page that really caught my eye. It was of local tutor Angela Lang and her two students, Miles Sitterly and Sam Davidson, with a Kate Shelley path behind them. As you'll hear, these boys are first grade and second grade. And Gina and I have explored that path for a couple of radio programs. So when I noticed a cleanup day is planned for this Saturday, May 8th from 9 to noon, I was curious how two young boys were inspired to embark on this project. So I called Angela, and this is what she told me.
How did you find out about the condition of the park?
Well, so I've grown up in Boone my whole life, and so I have heard of the Kate Shelley story. But when the pandemic kind of hit, I was tutoring a lot of my kids online or going to their homes just one-on-one to kind of help them keep up with their learning as, you know, schools had shut down. And so when we get done with our lesson, we usually have about 5-10 minutes or so. And one of my students, he was telling me about this Facebook group called Lost Boone. And he was very interested in the history of Boone and different things. And then one of the stories on there was the Kate Shelley story and about the different places where the old railroad track had gone through. And so he has a little friend that lives across the street that I used to be his teacher as well. And so it kind of became our little summer field trip. So we went down there and we were just kind of shocked at, you know, how overgrown a lot of the grass was, and the depot was pretty run down and needing a lot of repairs. And the trail was still pretty walkable, so there was maybe some sticks and things like that that needed to be picked up. So we walked the trail down to where the bridge was down by the river so they could see where the old railroad bridge was. And so it was just kind of became a little history lesson of different things around Boone. And her story is such a, you know, one a unique story of just thinking of others besides yourself in such a heroic act that she had done to, you know, save the people that were on that train. And so it just kind of was very interesting to these two little boys. One is in first grade right now, and the other one is in second grade right now as well.
So one of the reasons I wanted to get to you today was, yeah, I heard that you're going to have a cleanup day on Saturday.
We are this Saturday from 9 to noon. We are going to go down and clean up and just see, probably mow the grass and pick up any sticks or weeds or anything, and probably walk down the trail and see if there's anything we can pick up along there. I'm hoping to have some people there down there that can maybe fix like the bench that's down there. There's, you know, an old wagon wheel that's down there. And so just different people that have a lot more talent than I do of building things that can kind of create, just keep the, you know, the upkeep of the things that are down at the depot. I did, you know, I attended my first historical society meeting, and they said, you know, the depot itself is pretty run down. So they're not sure the quality of the foundation is in the depot. But I said, just even just having the outside looking like a clean, you know, a depot that's been cleaned up and just restored, I think that is fascinating for families and children to see. And the gentleman that does keep track of the grounds right now, he had a really great idea of the picnic area. And then along with like the story walk, have like these, they're called QR codes that you scan with your phone. And then you can have videos that pop up or different historical facts about Kate Shelley or different things within that community or even Boone community that they can find. And I thought that was a wonderful idea and very easy to have kids create a project out of that, I think. So I just went to the Boone Historical Society.
So
that's when I first kind of was researching different things about the depot. They said that's where I was talking to a couple friends, and they said you should really start with the Historical Society. And, you know, now once everything's starting to reopen, now I went to my first meeting about a month ago. And I said, this is what I want. And this is what these boys want, really. And I said, we're saving money so that we can, you know, provide we're just saving change in a pop bottle. We're trying there. And I said, it's kind of a little lesson in itself of, you know, saving money and then donating it to a different cause and things like that. And so there's a little lesson within that as well. And so we want to donate so we can kind of give funds to provide the equipment or the tools or the materials that might be needed to create a picnic area, or, you know, to buy new signs or different things that can be, you know, given to the historical society to build that story up again. Because it's such a, like I said, it's an amazing story to me. And I think, you know, a lot of our kids that I have am tutoring right now that live in Boone don't know this story as they should. So I think it's been an interesting, you know, to get my kids interested in this project has been. We're just meeting down in Mongona at the train depot. So we're going to meet there at 9 a.m. And hopefully, you know, I know it might not take the whole time, but I thought, well, get a start in seeing what needs to be fixed, or, you know, what really needs to be, you know, taken care of first, and kind of give us a direction of where to go to make sure that place, because we would love to have it up and running for families to tour, you know, at their own pace or own time, whatever they have, to be able to come down and have a, you know, lunch together or a picnic and then walk the trail together. So I would love to have that done by this summer so that they can enjoy that space down there, because it is beautiful down there. It's very beautiful.
July 6th, 1881, a fierce storm was raging. The rain just wouldn't stop coming down. The river and creeks were flooding in the Des Moines River Valley near the railroad station by Mongona Town. In the evening, a pusher train went out to search for men looking for washouts along the track. When they passed the Shelley family home, a mighty crash the Shelleys heard. The Honey Creek Bridge had just collapsed. 15-year-old Kate Shelley ran outside into the storm, saw two men trapped down in that river grave. She couldn't rescue them herself, but knew that midnight train would be sooner coming down the tracks this way. 100 years from now, folks will still speak her name. Kate Shelley will always be that girl who saved the train.
The newspaper article mentioned that the Boone County Historical Society was a sponsor for the cleanup day, so I called the president, Jessica Stanley, to find out how the two organizations were working together.
Yes, we were really excited to have this opportunity brought to us. Angela reached out, and she's actually joined our Kate Shelley committee. She's got a lot of great ideas on it, and we've taken this incentive to go ahead and get started on our plans for the Kate Shelley site.
She had some plans, but they were pretty hazy. Do you have any that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, we've got a lot of plans to create an outdoor walking tour. This would be done free of charge for individuals that wanted to go down and do a self-tour. So we're not going to use the depot building at this point. It's going to remain there. We've got some further work to do on that. But we envision what will be kind of a picnic area that'll have a park shelter and picnic tables. And then it will be a walking trail around the shelter that will tell the story of Kate Shelley. And so we'll have different signs set up around this area. And then that will actually lead to the Kate Shelley Trail. And at the front of the trail, we'll have, you know, the information about that. And then more signs as you go down the trail. And then finally, as you reach the river, it will actually have a sign showing the original bridge. And so we hope to create an entire new outdoor exhibit for people to be able to go to as they decide to. And so then they can go walk the trail and they can get to see all the story.
Well, that sounds very exciting, and I'm familiar with that area. I can hardly wait to see what you're going to do with it, because my memory is the way it is now. It's a little frustrating. You walk down and you see the piles that held the bridge, but it's hard to visualize what the bridge was like. So that's really a wonderful thing to do.
This has been a pet project for quite a few of us, and we're just finally to the point now that we really can jump in and take it off. You know, it's been a rough few years, but we're to the point where the Kate Shelley site will become our new priority as we get that one nice and set up again, so then we can keep moving forward.
Well, but good news for Boone and for
the Boone County Historical Society
as well. Thank you very much for telling us about it.
Yes, thank you very much.
Bye, Jessica.
Goodbye.
But if you go to Honey Creek in some dark summer storm, be sure you take a lantern flame to keep your spirit warm. For there will be a phantom train and foggy whistle cries, and in the lightning flare, you'll see Kate Shelley on the ties.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and your hosts for today are Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews. Our guest is Ed Fallon. Hi, Ed.
Hello, how are we doing?
Oh, well, great. Glad you're here. It's a pretty exciting day, I think. It's good to have you back on Local Talk. I remember when you were on the Great Climate March and would occasionally check in with us from wherever you were along the road, behind a cactus, talking to someone in an Amish buggy, as your fellow marchers walked from Los Angeles to meet up with a huge march in
Washington, D.C.
You have had many ambitious journeys since then, too, all the while broadcasting a weekly radio program, Fallon Forum, which is carried on several stations throughout the country. But most important for us, it is on KHOI every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Last week, when I was listening to Fallon Forum, this is what I heard.
First, I want to talk to you about the Race to Save the World. This is exciting. It's a really high-powered film by Joe Gantz. And if you don't know Joe Gantz, he's an Emmy-winning producer. He produced American Winter and Ending Disease and also Taxicab Confessions. The Race to Save the World looks at the work of a handful of individual activists who have been willing to take extreme risks in the fight against the climate emergency. Here's a quote from Joe's website. Encompassing protest and arrest, courtroom drama, and family turmoil, these everyday heroes push to create a sustainable world, often risking their relationships, careers, and freedoms in the process. The Race to Save the World is an inspiring call to action, urging each one of us to become climate warriors for a livable future. All right, full disclosure, I have a very brief cameo appearance in which I say something about not being careful to not be killed in a lightning storm. but the Great March for Climate Action is one of five or six activist enterprises that are profiled in the film. And there are four marchers in particular from that 2014 cross-country march who will be featured: Miriam Kasia, Michael Zambrano, Mac Wilkins, and Sean Glenn. It was an interesting experience to reflect on for me because for 8 months, I basically lived with this documentary crew. They followed the march every step of the way from California to Washington, D.C. And, it's interesting. I get a sense of what it's like to be on reality TV where you don't, you know that everything you do and say is being recorded. And that was the case with the Race to Save the World documentary crew. I remember the first day, and that was the 20-mile march through Los Angeles with 10 inches of rain, storms, clouds, lightning, thunder, a huge rainfall. I mean, walking up to our ankles and calves even, some people. And the documentary crew soldiered through that with us, to their credit. It was quite an experience, and I imagine even more complicated for them trying to deal with equipment in such weather. I remember another moment that was awkward for people, but again, very telling in terms of what this crew's focus was on. They were trying to capture not just the fact that people were walking across the country to raise the alarm about climate change, but also that, you know, in doing so, you know, you're living your life, and your life has become very different than it normally is in standard society. You're in a tent. You're living communally. You're eating out of the back of a truck. You're peeing in a box. You know, and the film crew, well, they didn't barge into the commodes. I'll give them that. But they did, for example, one night they wanted to get us, you know, preparing for bed. So they got people brushing their teeth. They got people crawling into their tents. They even, you know, put the camera up to the tent and showed people getting into their sleeping bags and whatnot. And for some people, and actually for me as well, that was a little awkward. But I understood why they did that. And again, for some people, it was not just awkward, but annoying and upsetting. But again, I think what Joe Gans has produced out of this film is pretty outstanding. And my hope is that it will inspire a lot of people to take some real serious action to address the climate crisis. Some of the other people featured in the film, I mean, really impressive people with tremendous commitment. Abby Brockway, she's a mom. And when an oil train derailed about a mile from her daughter's school, it just scared the heck out of her. And she got involved with a group that decided to block the train carrying oil through a nearby Washington State town. Well, that got her and four other people arrested. And the film takes us through that scenario and also through the court hearing, the trial in which Abby and others raise the necessity defense, saying we needed to do this action, even though it involved civil disobedience and getting arrested. We needed to do it to prevent greater harm, in her case, to her family, to her community, and more broadly to the entire planet.
Even though it involves civil disobedience and getting arrested.
So even though the film crew followed you on the march, the film was really about something else, it seems. How would you describe it to someone who is familiar with your style on the marches you've done?
Well, it was about, I think originally it was intended to be more focused on the march, but as Joe Gans, the producer, started seeing all the different things that people were doing across the country to address the climate crisis, the film broadened to include a lot more activities, and that's a good thing. The march is one of about five different actions. Another one is the court trial that's been filed nationwide. This particular one is at the state level. It's the Our Children's Trust court case, alleging that the state and federal governments have basically abandoned their obligation to make sure that the next generations have adequate access to food, water, clean air, all those things that are being compromised, not just by climate change, but by environmental neglect. Again, and the film also focuses on people doing some very edgy actions. Not that marching across the country for 8 months isn't pretty edgy. It was. It still is for the gal who's currently doing that, Hannah Bacon. But the, you know, putting a tripod in front of a train track and climbing up that, that's edgy. The actions of the valve turners turning off the flow of the oil, that's edgy. Kayaktivists taking their boats out into the water to block a Shell oil rig from heading up to the Arctic, that's pretty edgy. The point of the film is this is a crisis. Dramatic action is needed, and there are lots of things that people can do. And if you can't be one of those on the front lines, risking arrest or in the courtroom or marching across the country, there's lots of things you can do to support the people who are able to and willing to do that. So that's the bottom line. Yeah, it's about the march. It's about a lot more things, but it's about the urgency and the necessity of individual and collective action.
And we understand that it's going to launch this week.
Well, it actually launched nationwide on Earth Day, but the Climate March, which again is based here in Iowa, but is a national effort, well, and even international effort to encourage anybody who wants to use marching as a tool to try to address the climate crisis. We try to support those efforts. The Climate March is sponsoring a screening that starts today, May 5th, Cinco de Mayo, and runs through the 15th. And on the 15th at 7 p.m. Central Time, there will be a panel discussion that I'll be hosting, I'll be moderating, with three marchers. One from the Great March for Climate Action, Miriam Kasia, another from, Hannah Bacon, who's currently marching across the U.S., and then Pasha Morgan, who is also a very strong climate advocate. He walked from Des Moines to Texas in support of immigrant families' rights a couple of years ago. So it'll be an interesting panel discussion. And more broadly than just marching, their impressions of the film, their impressions of where we need to go as the political climate seems to be changing a bit, and how these strategies and tactics work into anyone who's concerned about addressing climate change.
And where will people be able to see your film and the panel discussion?
Well, if they go to theracetosavetheworld.com, I believe, or I think it's com, there's a connection there to the how to watch the film. And there's a few other groups that are hosting screenings. But if you go to the Climate March logo, click on that, you buy a ticket for $10. $4 of that goes to Climate March, which is really generous of the producers. And then you can watch that film anytime, I think, for a two-week period. That ticket also gets you access to the panel discussion. And if you miss the actual discussion live, you can catch it anytime until I think sometime in July it'll be available as recorded.
Okay, terrific. And I take it there's probably a trailer on your website as well for people.
There's a trailer on the Race to Save the World does have a trailer. It's about 2 minutes long, and it's worth seeing. I think people will be. I think Joe's idea was people watch films about how bad climate change is, and it just gets depressing. This is the film about, okay, we know we got a problem. Here's what creative, innovative, brave people are doing about it. So it's a kind of an angle that hopes to empower and inspire people to take action.
Is there any kind of call to action with the film or with the panel?
At the very end of the film and on the website, there are links to a number of organizations that people can get involved with that are taking action. Some national organizations, some local ones. Bold Iowa is mentioned there as well. And so is Extinction Rebellion, which is the very edgy, direct action-oriented effort spawned in England, which I talk about on this week's program as well, because they're in the news again. But the idea is that, there's a lot of things happening locally, nationally, internationally, and there's all sorts of ways that people can get involved to try to elevate the importance of speaking out. I would say this too, Gina. People forget that the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that was a political moment where Congress and the President Johnson got together and said, we need to do something to protect our Black Americans' right to vote. And that happened at the political level, but it would not have gotten to that point if, millions of people hadn't been in the streets, risking arrest, sitting in at diners, freedom riders on buses, marches from Selma to Montgomery, all these different things that involve people taking risks, being creative, putting their lives on the line. That's what elevated the importance of racial justice and moved and led to the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act as well.
Kind of a way of cooperation.
Yeah, bringing all those tools together and putting enough pressure on the political system that it finally takes action. And I think we're seeing that right now with President Biden.
And I mean, it raises us all up as a whole society.
Yes.
Yeah, but it still takes a long time. I mean, you made a comment when we were talking about this program that when you did the march starting in 2014, and then there was this huge, huge march in, everybody was supposed to be coming to Washington. We didn't think that it was not going to progress any faster than it has since 2014, you know.
Well, I actually did think it would progress faster because I...
That's what I mean. We didn't
think okay,
it.
Yeah.
We thought that people would say this, Miss March, and they'd really make a difference, but sort of like, oh, well.
I've been a climate activist since 2007. Pretty much it's been my primary focus and even my single focus. It dropped much of that time. And honestly, in 2014, I thought that we would be a lot closer to the kind of dramatic action we're starting to see now. Hopefully it's not too late. But my one beef with scientists is everything they say is true. Everything they say is coming to pass. The problem is it's coming to happen. It's happening a lot sooner than most scientists have predicted. And so, you know, that's my one beef is that we don't have as much time to address this as scientists have been saying. And so hopefully between, you know, the actions that have been happening, the actions that might be inspired because of films like this and the political climate that is changing nationally, we'll see the kind of a shift that we need to see.
Well, it's a race.
Boy.
Yeah.
The virus helped a little.
Yeah, that's true. We made changes during the virus that we thought we'd never be able to do.
As far as gas consumption and fuel burning and
right.
driving.
And now there's a way to make money off the crisis.
Well, for some people. I know plenty of small businesses that have been struggling quite a bit. But,
well, no. What I mean is, it's Biden's line. When I think about the climate crisis, I think of jobs.
Okay.
You can turn this to your advantage by rebuilding better.
Right. Good point. Yeah. There's a lot more jobs in managing in energy conservation, for example, which is huge, than there is in building a pipeline. Yeah. You might have a bunch of jobs while the construction is happening. But for example, Dakota Access Pipeline right now, I believe what I've heard is there are about 15 jobs in Iowa relevant to that. No, you've got a lot more people employed in solar, wind, and certainly in conservation. So, yeah, I think Biden is right about that. And I think it's hard to argue that. I mean, you look at the evidence and it's pretty clear. Yeah, there's a lot of jobs to be had in doing the right thing relevant to climate and the environment.
Well, we shall see.
Thank you much for all your work on this topic.
You're
welcome. It does seem like we've been talking about it for decades, and we're slow to action, slow to.
That seems to be the hallmark of our species, unfortunately. But, the tiger is about to attack us, and we can respond pretty quickly and effectively. But when we think, that volcano, that will never be a problem. Yeah, it's the big threats that don't seem immediate that come back to bite us. And so climate is certainly one of those. It's probably the worst we've ever faced on this planet. And hopefully we are responding quickly enough and dramatically enough to be able to make the changes we need.
We began this program with a celebration, and we will end it with a memorial for Donald Wannsee, who died on April 21st, 2021, at age 88, at his home on the Meskwaki settlement, a most significant activist and elder. Don was a student at Iowa State University in the early 1970s. Along with his wife, Priscilla Lasley Wannsee, they co-founded the United Native American Student Association, UNASA, with two other students. He was seminal in the establishment of the American Indian Studies program at Iowa State University. Donald went on to obtain his Master's of Social Work degree at the University of Iowa. Donald helped establish the National Coalition of Indian Controlled School Boards, which eventually led to the Meskwaki creating their own schools in the settlement without the interference of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Donald served several terms on the Meskwaki Tribal Council and mentored many young Native American men and women. His legacy will live on. Thanks to David Gradwell for this statement a more detailed article about Donald Walmsley's activism and outstanding achievements is in the Des Moines Register on April 30th, 2021. But I just got an update from Pat Schlarbaum, who told me that there's an announcement today that 88 of the 99 counties returned the vaccine. The only county approaching herd immunity is Tama County, which of course is where the Meskwaki settlement is. And this is a testament to Donald's leadership. If you want to save the people, get them vaccinated.
That's terrific. He was sure a great leader and a good man.
Well, and his daughter has been very involved with several marches and plenty of actions on climate, on behalf of climate change here. She's really inherited his passion for the earth and for protecting our people. And that's Danielle Wanity, and a good friend and someone who has been quite a fellow traveler when it comes to the kind of actions portrayed in The Race to Save the World.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, when I was trying to decide what to read, the Danielle's statement on her Facebook page was what I could. It is worth mentioning, though, a couple of organizations. NAGRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, which was established in 1990. It is fundamentally a human rights legislation and is in place to protect cultural and biological remains of Native Americans and their ancestors. And ICWA, Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978, is the federal law that governs the removal and out-of-home placement of American Indian children.
Thank you so much, Ed.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Have a great day. Cinco de Mayo.
Cinco de Mayo. This is KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and your hosts for today have been Susan Franzen and myself, Gina McAndrews. Other voices you have heard are Juan Rodriguez, Daryl Morin, Ed Fallon, and Angela Lang.
Jennifer Stanley.
Remember that you can also hear Local Talk online at khoifm.org. And find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. At noon, you can hear Capital Week with Dennis Hart and Laura Bellin.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was The Ballad of Kate Shelley from the same album, a selection from Dinner in Mexico, Authentic Mexican Music, and The Best Spanish Guitar Music. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! At the top of the hour. Morning Masterpieces will follow at 9 a.m.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop, as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or you can contact us through our website at khoifm.org. That's also all you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member, or you can renew your membership today. Just go to the website and hit the yellow Donate Become a Member button. If you enjoyed the show, please tell all your friends. Remember that your participation as a listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.